Today, horse racing has become a science to test the skill of the professional and unprofessional handicapper. The well-informed turf man must know the individual merits of the competing horses. He must consider all the elements: wind velocity, humidity, rotation of the earth, time of day, temperature, drift indication, lay of the land.
There were these two racing dudes named Aaron and Jared who had advice on racing and they wanted to share it. Started a website where players go to see all their picks. The goal was make the fans some money and to cut down the risk. They put the plan into motion and at first it seemed silly. Make a website where the expert picks are freer than Willie. From a racetrack veteran to just a beginner, there's one place that you want to go to find you a winner. As a matter of fact, I want to hit the exacta. There's only one site that you'll keep coming back to. So next time that the horses all line up at the post, make sure you use the website that'll win you the most. Whether Churchill, Oaklawn, Gulfstream Park, Saratoga, and all tracks in between, there's only one site to go to. When it comes to your racing needs and all of your bets, plus it's got a catchy name that no one ever forgets. RacingDudes.com for all of your needs. RacingDudes.com for all of your leads. RacingDudes.com for all of your bets. RacingDudes.com, as good as it gets. RacingDudes.com for all of your needs. RacingDudes.com for all of your leads. RacingDudes.com for all of your bets. RacingDudes.com, as good as it gets.
Welcome to Blinkers Off. I'm Jared Welch. He's Aaron Halterman. What's going on, dude?
It is a very special edition of Blinkers Off this week. Man, we have landed one of our best interviews. Well, it's not even one of it. It is our best interview ever.
Yeah. I mean, this week you guys don't even have to listen to us other than right now, because we're gonna turn it over to Mr. John White. I mean, if you don't know John White, you need to know John White. This interview, I can't oversell this enough. It's amazing.
The thing about John is, he's a very easy interview. I learned when doing this, you just kind of got to lead him in some sort of direction and he'll take off with it. So it was great.
Yeah. You'll notice in this interview, we recorded it a couple days ago, recording this on Thursday evening. You'll notice in the interview, you hear very few words from us and a lot from John, because we honestly, he's so good at what he does. I mean, this guy has been around forever. He knows what he's doing. So you just kind of have to let him go, and he answers his own questions and gets so insightful. It's amazing stuff.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, and he'll get into what all he's done in racing, but there isn't anything the guy hasn't done short of, like, you know, riding a horse. That's about the only thing the guy hasn't done in racing. So it's going to be awesome. It's kind of a week to relax a little bit. It's the calm before the massive storm that is Kentucky Derby week on Monday.
Yep. So today's show, we interview Santa Anita oddsmaker and longtime horse racing journeyman John White, who gives us thoughts on the upcoming Derby and Oaks. White will also discuss how he started in the game and crafting the perfect morning line odds. Let's go. We are pumped to welcome John White to Blinkers Off. For those of you who don't know who John is a Santa Anita oddsmaker, longtime racing journalist, handicapper, analyst, and racing official. How's it going, John?
Doing great, guys. Good to be with the dudes.
Really appreciate you coming on, John. And, you know, before we start in with this very complex Kentucky Derby we've got staring us in the face this year, just kind of tell the fans a little bit about all the jobs you've had in racing. I mean, you have had a laundry list of jobs. There's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, we don't want to spend too much time on that because we wouldn't have much time left for the Kentucky Derby. But, I mean, kind of overall, I started with the Daily Racing Form in 1974, which was my goal as early as in high school. When I was a journalism major, I even we had a career counselor come through one day and ask everyone in my journalism class if anybody knew what they would be doing 4 years from then, and I was the only guy that raised my arm, and I said that I'd probably be working for the Daily Racing Form, and the guy started to argue with me, and then I didn't say a word, but about three kids in the front row said, "No, sir, you better shut it down, because this guy most likely will be working for the Daily Racing Form." And keep in mind, over on the wall in that very journalism class, on the chalkboard, the teacher was kind enough to allow me to post the odds for that year's Kentucky Derby, which was Secretariat's Kentucky Derby. So when Secretariat won that Kentucky Derby, on the following Monday in school, because I had written in my high school paper in March that Secretariat would win the Triple Crown. I said, going out on a limb and living dangerously, I dare say 1973 will be a historic year, as Secretariat will become the first Triple Crown winner since the Great Citation in 1948. Not many high school papers have something like that. When Secretariat won the Kentucky Derby, of course, broke the track record that day by 3/5 of a second. The following Monday, as I was going through the halls at high school, kids were all congratulating me on a great pick and what a great derby. It was like I'd won the homecoming football game or something. And in fact, in one of my classes, a history class, the teacher at the start of the class got up to the chalkboard and started to write. Then he turned around. He says, "Before we start class today, let's congratulate John on such a great pick in that Kentucky Derby." So kind of had the whole high school buzzing about Secretariat. Of course, he didn't let me down, because he went on to win the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes and the Belmont in one of probably the greatest performance by a thoroughbred in history. So I did start with the Daily Racing Form and worked at many tracks throughout the country for the Racing Form and did a number of things for them. I was a chart caller. I was a columnist. I was a reporter. I was a handicapper. So, pretty much did everything you can do with them. And I spent also a year in 1979 at the age of 24 as a steward in the state of Washington. I was asked by the Washington State Racing Commission if I wanted to be a steward, and I did take them up on that. I took a leave of absence on the racing form, and so I spent time doing that in 1979, and I'm regarded as the youngest steward in the history of thoroughbred racing, not only in the United States, but in the entire world. There's never been a steward as young as 24 years old. And later, I would also work as a steward in the state of Idaho and also in the state of California. So I've worked in three states as a steward. I've written for the Blood Horse. I've been a horse owner. I was with HRTV for 12 years. And in fact, one of my great honors was I was the very first person asked to be on air at HRTV, and I was the very first person on the air at HRTV. So that was a great honor. And I've been a morning line maker. I've made morning lines for a number of Breeders' Cups, including the one that Zenyatta won, the Breeders' Cup Classic, and was so unbelievable, as Trevor Denman said. And that's a lot of pressure. It's very, very difficult. But so that's certainly been something that's been challenging. And I'll be doing again this year at Santa Anita this following fall. So that's kind of a nutshell, and I'm sure I'm leaving out quite a few things. I've written for a lot of newspapers and magazines, even the Canadian Horse and the Washington Thoroughbred Magazine and the Thoroughbred Times and the Thoroughbred Record. And so it's been a good long career in racing, and it's been over 40 years that I've actually been working in racing. So, that's pretty good, because my dad, who was the guy that got me interested in the sport in the first place, because my dad had a second job, and he's a golf course superintendent, and he had a second job working part of the year at two different tracks in Washington State, Yakima Meadows, which was the track I was a steward at in 1979, and then also at Playfair in my hometown of Spokane. And my dad worked in the money room in the mutual department at both of those tracks. But he was a big fan before that and loved to handicap, read the racing form the night before with his red pencil. And in fact, I was just showing Steve Bick. Steve Bick was in town for the Santa Anita Derby, and I had dinner with Steve Bick and Jay Pribman one evening, and then we had Steve Bick over to my house. My wife cooked a nice lasagna dinner, and I was actually showing Steve Bick the first racing form that I ever bought, and I don't think too many people still have their very first racing form. And mine was from 1966. I was 11 years old, and I bought it kind of on the sly. I was at Long Acres, the beautiful track near Seattle, with my dad, And I went off and on my own. The racing form was 50 cents at that time. And I went off and bought the form and put it under my shirt so he didn't know I had it. And that night, we were staying with my grandparents and that lived near Seattle. And after dinner, which was my dad's tradition, after dinner, he would go get his racing form and his red pencil and start to handicap. And when he did, I went and got my racing form and got a red pencil. And I still have the red marks in that racing form, which are very rudimentary. It's kind of comical to look at. I had no idea, of course, what I was even doing. But my dad says, "What? Where'd you get that?" And I said, "Well, I bought it." And so and that's kind of a milestone because that was 1966. So that's going to be one of the – here's another thing I do. I write a weekly column for ExpressBet.com. And, in fact, this past week – was my 500th column that I've written for ExpressBet. So this coming summer, I'm planning to write a column kind of looking back at that purchase of that very first racing form because that was 1966. Well, here we are in 2016. So that'll be 50 years since I bought my first racing form.
Wow.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, he basically just told us all he does. I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, 40 years and to do – what you've done, I mean, to be the youngest steward of ever in the world, you know, the morning line. I mean, let's talk briefly about the morning line just because, I mean, you've like you said, I mean, you gave the morning line for the Breeders' Cup Classic, the Zenyatta one, and all the races you've done. And how much pressure do you feel when you make these morning lines knowing, I mean, what's kind of the key strategy for, you know, for picking out your favorites and how the odds shape up in the morning line?
Well, unlike a lot of tracks here in Southern California, the morning line is regarded as important, and it is because, you know, the tracks realize the importance of it. Southern California was a jurisdiction in which, unlike a lot of tracks across the country, before the days of simulcasting, California were among the few tracks that posted the morning line on the tote board. So when you looked at the tote board, you saw the morning line right next to the actual betting odds. So right there, you have pressure. For instance, when I made the morning line at Playfair, a little track in Washington State, my hometown, you know, your morning line went up on the board as the starting point for betting. But once the betting kicked in, your morning line went away. Of course, it was in the program, but I mean, it wasn't there for kind of everybody in the track to see. If you made a horse 20-1 and he's 8-5, you know, that's sitting right on the tote board in Southern California. So, and now nowadays that's going into the racing form. And the morning line has changed significantly from when I first made it in the 1970s, because in the 1970s, the morning line was made the morning of the races. That's why it's called the morning line. And now it has become an advance line, but because it's got the name morning line, it's still called that because that's what it's been called all along. But it's changed because now you're making the line. I got to put it in, send it in early enough so it goes into the racing form. So many things can change. For instance, in Santa Anita, you'll get rain and races come off the turf. Well, again, if you were making the morning line the morning of the races, you would know which races they're going to pull off the turf unless you got a storm that came in during the day. But in most cases, you would be able to make a morning line for the main track. And a scratch can affect the pace. And, I mean, there's so many variables, as you two guys know, as fans and as good handicappers. So, but here in Southern California, I mean, you have radio shows, people, I mean, everyone is focusing on that morning line. So it is a lot of pressure. One of the main functions of it is to try to pick the correct favorite, to have the correct favorite. And I monitor that very closely to see how well I'm doing. In fact, I came across an article from the 1980s that was written in a California breeding magazine about the morning line. And it was stated in that article that you're doing a good job if you have the right favorite about 66% of the time. And in all the years I've made the morning line at Santa Anita, I've never gone a meet where I was under 70%. And in fact, one winter spring meeting at Santa Anita a couple of years ago, and that's a very long meeting. And again, you're going through the winter where you get some real weather issues, but I hit 80%. So I had the right favorite 8 out of 10 times for that entire meeting. So that's one of the main functions, I believe, because of the fact that people want handicappers, to a large extent, bettors, serious bettors, are often trying to beat the favorite. And if you can be correct a lot of the times in who the favorite will be, again, in my case, generally 7 out of 10 times, people at least have a good starting point because they can look at which horse they're going to take a stand up against. So that's one of the things that I take pride in, and but it's not easy. I mean, there's sometimes where you'll look at a race and you've got two horses that could go either way, and I might make a horse 9-5 and another horse 2-1 in the race. When I do that, I'm telling the public, hey, this could go either way, or I might make a horse 8-5 and another horse 9-5. And if I make them that close, you know, that's saying, hey, this could go either way. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if I make Songbird 1-9. This was the first time I had made a 1-9 shot in the program 3 times during a meeting, and all 3 times she went off at 1-9 on the board. And you can't make a horse lower than 1-9 in the program because on the tote board, that's the lowest it can go on the tote board. You can't have 1-10 or 1-20. Right. And actually, Songbird in 2 of those races was 1-20, and then the other race she was 1-10. So, but that's one of the big things. And to show you, I followed a very good morning line maker, Jeff Tufts. I mean, this guy did a superlative job. And so it's like trying to follow in the footsteps of Trevor Denman, for instance, if you're a track announcer, or following in the footsteps of Michael Jordan if you're playing basketball or something. I mean, believe me, the bar was set very high by this individual because Jeff Tuss was outstanding at his craft. And he was a guy that, you know, would be very accurate in making the line. And so people around here in Southern California, unlike, again, other parts of the country, were not as much effort as put into the morning line. People around here expect it to be pretty good. And to show you on a radio show just at this past Santa Anita meet, a guy said, well, this horse is the 9-5 favorite on the morning line, but I think he's going to go off at 8-5. Now, look, I'm going to tell you, that's almost pointless to even say. I mean, what is the point of that? I made him 9-5. He's going to go off 8-5. I mean, that's like you say, hey, he's spot on, but he's acting like I'm off. And you know, when you're off is when you make a horse 10-1 and he goes off at 9-5. Right. Or you make a horse 9-5 and he goes off at 10-1. A lot of tracks will just have some guy in the racing office do the morning line, or, you know, they'll just have a guy that doesn't really have the experience. And it's a real art to make a good morning line because you've got to know trainer trends and workout patterns. And when I sit down on a card, let's say like the Santa Anita Derby card, from the time I get the first PPs and I sit down to start my entire process, before I even start to get putting any odds on races, that will take me 4 to 5 hours of work of going through the workouts, looking up breeding, marking the horses, how they've run against each other, because that's one of the things I key on. If horses have already faced each other, what were the odds when they faced each other? That's important. Mm-hmm. I go through and look up on Briss how they rank in the power rankings at Briss, and I use everything I possibly can use to make a good morning line. I get help from some individuals. Brad Free, I will look at his analysis in the racing form because fortunately that's one of the few things that is available while I'm in the process of making the morning line. I'll look at Michael Hammersley's picks in the racing form. Bob Mazursky, who is a very good handicapper, was a longtime handicapper for the Los Angeles Times, now does a handicap where he has the horses in his order of preference with odds. And he's kind enough to send me that. So that's another person I can look at. And we differ quite a bit. Again, he doesn't spend the time on his odds that I do, but he's such a good handicapper. What these people give me is a safety check to where if I'm maybe overlooking a horse, if one of these guys that I'm monitoring happen to like a horse, I'll go back and say, oh, I see, and I'll lower a horse. Maybe I had the horse 8-1. There was a race at Santa Anita on Santa Anita Derby Day, the Providencia Stakes, And the filly that won it, I had her 8-1, and she ended up going off at like 3-1. She opened up like at 5-2 or 2-1, pretty strongly bet right away. And she ended up winning, and I wasn't watching TVG, but I understand Kurt Hoover, who I've worked with for many years in many capacities in television, evidently spent like 20 minutes on TVG making the big case for this filly. And, you know, I feel bad that I had her 8-1. She went off at 3 and then won like she was a Zenyatta. But it's going to happen sometimes, and this is where I was let down a little bit by the guys I monitor. Another guy that really gives me tremendous help because he's a very good individual in making a morning line himself is a handicapper here in Southern California by the name of Aaron Hess. And he's also a horse owner, and he provides me invaluable help. So I have these guys that kind of give me a safety net and help me along the process. I had wanted desperately for many years to have access to either Thoroughgraph or Ragazin numbers, because when I was making the morning line for years at Fairplex, I would make the morning line, and then when I would listen to one of these radio shows here in Southern California on Saturday and Sunday, or Sunday, one of these Ragazin guys would get on or something, and they'd say, well, in the third race, I think number 5, Zenyatta, is an absolute cinch today, blah, 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 and I'd look, and I got the horse like 8-1, and I would just cringe, because I know this horse is probably going to open up at like 4-5 or something. Because these guys have such a network of followers, and that these numbers are so good, that, and I'm in the dark on that. So I had wanted access to that for years. And finally, about 3 years ago, I was able to get the Thoroughgraph numbers, and that was really helping me in the morning line. But then after about 2 years of that, I was told that, well, now you've got to make the morning line a day earlier so it can go in the racing form. And so that went out the window, because the Thoroughgraph numbers aren't available until the day after I have to submit the morning line. So you get the feeling like you have one hand tied behind your back a lot of times in this job. And considering that, I feel, you know, kind of proud in terms of I'm able to do as good as I can. Even on the day, the Santa Anita Derby card, that I had a horse that's unusual for me to get bet down from 8-1 to 3-1 and win. The good news is the biggest race of the day, the Santa Anita Derby, I almost matched it exactly. I mean, I had the right favorite in terms of more spirit, and had him a slight favorite over Dancing Candy. That was correct. I mean, everything you looked at in that Santa Anita Derby line was spot on. And that's the thing that you feel the best about, because obviously the Santa Anita Derby was the race that was the most under the microscope on that card.
Right.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And, you know, that was not an easy morning line to make, because you had to know that those two horses were going to be very close in odds. So, yeah, that was very tough. And I'm glad you clarified to people, because a lot of handicappers, they love to rip on the morning line maker. You know this, I'm sure. And what you just laid out, this is not an easy process, and this is not a process where you just look at the PPs and give out numbers. So I'm glad you clarified that for everyone. And I want to kind of switch gears, because you mentioned Songbird, who you correctly made the morning line 1-9 choice, you know, like you said, and obviously a correct choice, because she was a clear standout. I want to ask you, just how good do you think Songbird is? And if she would have stayed healthy, could she have competed with the top class males in this crop?
Very good question. And by the way, there aren't too many morning line makers that would make a 1-9 favorite.
Yeah.
One of the few others I've ever done that with was Zenyatta. And so there are some tracks that don't want you to do that because they feel it blunts the wagering. And one thing that's really good about Santa Anita is they've allowed me to make horses like that 1-5 or 1-9 or 2-5 if I feel that's merited. And Santa Anita's smart on that because, again, it lends credibility. When you have a track where they say, don't make anybody lower than like 4-5, and believe me, there are some tracks where the management feels that that's the case, or they don't want you to make a 50-1 shot. And, you know, some races, I wish I could make horses like 200 to 1, so, you know, but it's at least they're allowing you to go to 50 to 1, and there are a lot of tracks around the country. And I've also received some flack from trainers sometimes when I've made a 50 to 1 shot. There was a trainer one time that came up to me, was very upset that I had made his horse 50 to 1, and I said, well, what was the horse's odds the last time it ran? He said 80. And I said, well, where did the horse run? And he said, dead last. And I said, well, you know, what do you think? You're going to get bet today or something? And he says, no, I'll bet you I'm less than 50 to 1. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll bet a cup of coffee. Well, his horse opened up at about 20. And I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to lose my coffee. But, and in fact, Kurt Hoover and a number of other people in the Santa Anita press box, I was telling them about this. And even my wife, who writes for the Blood Horse magazine, and in fact is an Eclipse Award honorable mention writer, her name's Tracy Gantz, she was there that day to cover the stakes race, and I had told her about this. So a lot of people were watching that tote board because they wanted to know to see if this trainer was going to be right for the cup of coffee. And as I say, in the early betting, the horse was like 20, 22 to 1. But then they came out onto the track, and it was 26, then 30, 35, 45, 48. They were going in the gate. The horse was 49. Horse went off at like 53 to 1. And did I ever get my cup of coffee? No. It's typical with a, you know, people in racing a lot of times. I got stiffed for my cup of coffee. So, but to answer your question on Songbird, and as I say, that is a very good question. I think that the thing about her that is exciting and kind of almost scary, we really have no clue at this time just how good she might be. You know, she, in some respects, reminds me of Landa Lucy, who I saw win the Lassie Stakes at Hollywood Park by 21 lengths. Now, that's a 6-furlong race, not like the Belmont Stakes at Secretariat won by 31 lengths. You know, to win a mile-and-a-half race by 31 lengths, and, of course, that was phenomenal, as I've already stated, that most likely is the greatest performance by a thoroughbred in history. But to win a 6-furlong stakes race by 21 lengths in its own way is tremendous. And she shattered the stakes record that day held by Terlingua, who would go on to be the dam of Stormcat. And Landa Lucy never lost. And in fact, in her final career start, she only won by like 2.5 lengths, and she was getting knocked by the people in the press box. Well, maybe she's, you know, going downhill here and so forth. And well, I think perhaps we found out the reason she didn't maybe run her A race that day. Shortly thereafter, she died. And so, you know, that was very sad. She never made it to her 3-year-old year. And Dwayne Lucas, I've talked to him about Landa Lucy, and believe me, he was already thinking Kentucky Derby with her during her 2-year-old campaign. I mean, she was actually a national sensation. When she died, she made the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. I mean, a 2-year-old filly to be her a news item on the CBS Evening News kind of gives you a glimpse of how she had risen in terms of her profile nationally. And Songbird, in terms of talent, to me, is in this same realm, because I think perhaps, you know, when a horse gets sick shortly after a race, it's not unreasonable to think that that bug might have been incubating there during the race, you know, for that race. And this Songbird won the Santa Anita Oaks. She won it very easily, but it really kind of wasn't one of her best races. And now I think we can actually see why. And how great are you when you can win a grade one race by daylight in hand, you know, with the rider just sitting there like a workout, and you're not even really perhaps 100% physically. So these are the type of things that make her very, very, you know, exciting, as I say. And in terms of her numbers and just everything that we see, I think there's every chance that she would have been the winner of the Kentucky Derby, quite frankly. I mean, I see absolutely no reason that she wouldn't. If I were making the morning line for the Kentucky Derby and she was in it, I would make her the favorite. I'd make her the favorite over Nyquist. I think people have less questions about Songbird at this point than they do about Nyquist. So it would be not an easy call because I have, you know, you have to respect Nyquist too. He's undefeated and went back to Gulfstream Park and absolutely buried Mohamed, who was regarded as, you know, the big deal back east, and he was no match whatsoever for Nyquist. So, as I say, you have to respect Nyquist, and you couldn't make it to be a case of that Songbird, you'd make her a tremendous favorite over Nyquist. But personally, I would make Songbird the favorite. And again, one of the things about the morning line, you're not giving your opinion of how you think the horse's odds should be. You're trying to predict what you think the odds are going to be. So in a large respect, I'm not handicapping just the horses, but I'm trying to handicap the bettors. And that's one reason I don't mind to get the input. I read articles. I keep my ear to the ground. I listen to radio shows and so forth. And try to, and as I say, I read Brad Fried. I check his selections. I check other people's selections. Because how they feel about a horse or a race gives you a glimpse of how the public might view a horse or a race. And as I say, one of the reasons I say that Songbird, I think, whether she would win the Kentucky Derby or not, I feel she would go off as the favorite, is because of the listening to how she's perceived by the public. And, you know, the public at this point is absolutely agog with her much more than Nyquist. So, you know, this is one of those cases you could be wrong in making her the favorite for the Kentucky Derby, but I wouldn't even hesitate in terms of making her the favorite, and I think she would have gone favored. And if you have Songbird running her A race, I think there's every chance that she would win the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, I mean, and to your point, it's with these days, it's got to be so hard because of social media and the reach of so many people out there that the word gets out, you know, that this horse is running or training really well. And then, of course, you have a filly, you know, the coverage they do for the Kentucky Derby now these days, it's, you know, that she would get tons of play. And so you got to take that into account, that the lone filly in the race who's undefeated, probably going to take a lot of money. And I'm sure social media would be blowing up about it. So that's a good point when you think about these.
Let me interrupt you to give you a perfect example of where how I perceive what the public will do differs from how I think a race will be run, how a horse will do in the race, and that's Zyconic, whose mother is Zenyatta.
Right.
And in his second career start, because he appeared to close in his debut, mm-hmm. and I think he did close some, but it was more of a function of the horses in front were really not running very fast. He got a very low buyer in the race, and I really felt that he was going to be way over bet second time out as he was first time out, because he's getting bet just based on being an offspring of the great Zenyatta. And the thing that makes that a poor bet, in my opinion, at this point, is she's unproven as a broodmare. You don't know whether she's going to be a successful broodmare, or like most outstanding race mares, kind of a dud as a broodmare. There's very few top race mares that have been top broodmares. Personal Ensign was one. Serena's Song was one. But they're far and few between. More of them are like Winning Colors. You know, here was Winning Colors, and she had a tremendous pedigree. She was a great, big, strong filly. But she really was a failure as a broodmare. That's actually more par for the course. And again, considering Zenyatta's size, that's another thing that kind of comes into play here, because oftentimes, you know, a real successful broodmare isn't someone like a tank, like Zenyatta was. So to me, you know, the jury is out on what kind of mother Zenyatta is going to be. But yet, because of the sentimentality and so forth, you know, I made Zyconic a pretty, you know, made him the favorite when I didn't even think, and I my selections go in the program at Santa Anita, and I didn't pick Zyconic 1, 2, 3. Now that doesn't happen very often. 98% of the time I go ahead and pick the horse that I make the favorite, and I do that because I'm trying to have people that walk into the track and that are just trying to bet winners or maybe single horses in these exotics like the pick, like the double, the pick 3, the pick 4, the pick 5, the pick 6, to where they can look at a guy's selections and see who I like in a race. And I don't, I'm not trying to be creative with my selections there for the most part. I'm trying to pick who I feel has the best chance to win. And in most races, the horse with the best chance to win is the favorite, because the favorite wins about 33% of the time. Now, when I was young, and I mean really young, going back clear into like the 1960s, and in my formative years of handicapping, I started to buy into this line of thinking on by the part of a lot of horse players that said, I don't want to bet the favorite because the favorite loses like 7 out of 10 times, which is true. That's statistically proven, and it's been that way in racing forever. Even with the proliferation of information we have today, the favorites have remained the same, which I find fascinating. Even though we have video capability today and all this information, and that we can get on the computer and check this and that and so forth, the percentage of winning favorites is the same today as the information that we had, which was bare bones in the racing form, that first racing form I bought in 1966. It didn't even have nearly the kind of workout information or breeding information or trip notes, or it didn't even have fractions for the horse and their past performances. I mean, you talk about just bare bones, and yet the public was correct about 3 out of 10 times in picking the favorite as they are today. So, you know, you have this situation where all this proliferation of information, and yet that has stayed stagnant, and I find that quite interesting. But, you know, this is a case where I really felt that this Zenyatta Austrian was going to be way over bet. Now, what's interesting is I could have been right and I could have been wrong, because I will give the Zyconic an excuse, which I didn't even realize at the time. Zyconic broke very poorly in the race and spotted the field about 8 lengths. Now, it's one thing to break slow like Zenyatta, but Zyconic, I mean, was ridiculous. I mean, almost didn't come away at all, and then made a good move on the backstretch. And, you know, then after having to make such a premature move like that, you know, really didn't run very well, as I didn't think Zyconic would. But Zyconic did show some ability in that race, and it wasn't until days later I came to find out, and here's where you talk about the internet again, John Sheriffs had found somebody had taken a picture, and actually a bird had flown right in front of the stall at the exact moment the gates opened in that race, and this horse was looking directly at a bird in front of him. And so I can't really blame this horse, because, I mean, here your gate opens and this bird's in your face. And it kind of reminds me of a race when I was a chart caller for the racing form at Santa Anita. I was very fastidious with my trip notes and went through the replay with a fine-tooth comb. And Gary Stevens was riding a horse one time on the backstretch, and a bird came in and actually hit his horse in the head. And so I had that in the chart comment. And it would be something like Zenyatta settled into stride early, was struck by in the head by a bird at the half-mile pole, you know, rallied four wide and lacked the needed late response, something of that ilk, which was similar in a way to one of the most famous charts, which was done by the great chart caller Jack Wilson. This was at Tropical Park in Florida, and he wrote something that would have been like, Zenyatta broke alertly, set the pace, went around an alligator at the 3/16th pole, and, you know, won driving, something like that. So he had the alligator in the chart. And so I had this horse getting hit in the head by a bird, and a couple of days later, I get a call in the press box at Santa Anita, and it's Gary Stevens. And he says, John, I said, yeah, what's up? But usually the guy's going to be calling to complain that you wrote something or whatever. You know, they're going to disagree with something that you did or whatever. So I was kind of dreading the call. And he says, I wanted to thank you. And I said, oh, for what? And he says, well, I don't know if you remember, but I rode this horse the other day, and you had it in the chart that the horse got hit in the head by a bird. And I said, yeah. I said, I noticed that on the replay. And he says, well, I'm so glad that you did, because he says, when I got off the horse, you know, the owner and trainer came over and they said, what happened? And I said, well, he got hit in the head by a bird on the backstretch. And they said, oh, yeah, sure. And he goes, no, really, I'm telling you, he got hit in the head. And he says, they never believed me. So he says, you had it there in black and white, in print. And so I want to thank you so much because you saved me in terms of my credibility with these guys that thought I was just trying to make up an excuse out of thin air. Because the horse actually was hit in the head by a bird.
Well, okay, so on that, let's go right to what everyone wants to talk about, and that's Kentucky Derby. And I want to know, you know, is Nyquist going to be a horse out front that's going to get hit in the head by a bird? I mean...
Well, if we only knew that ahead of time. First of all, if we even knew he was going to be in front. So, I mean, that's, you know, we don't know that. I would be kind of surprised if he'll be in front. I'm expecting Dancing Candy to be in front, even though I don't expect him to set anywhere near of a wicked pace as he did in the Santa Anita Derby. As I noted recently in my ExpressBet.com column, I went back and checked the charts for 79 Santa Anita Derbies. This was the 79th Santa Anita Derby, and only twice has a horse run a faster half mile than Dancing Candy. So he was tied for the third fastest half mile of 45 1/5 in the history of the Santa Anita Derby. And of all the horses that had run a sub 46 half in the history of the Santa Anita Derby, Dancing Candy, by finishing fourth, had the best finish of anybody. So while a lot of people are down on him, and including me, because he's got three strikes in my strike system, and in my strike system, the key is to have zero strikes or one strike, and that means you're in the prime group, because the vast majority of Kentucky Derby winners, 37 of the last 43 Kentucky Derby winners, have had zero strikes or no strikes. And if you have two strikes in my system, you're in the unlikely to win category, because five of the last 43 Kentucky Derby winners have won with two strikes. If you have more than two strikes, you're in the victories almost impossible group, which unfortunately for me, that's Shagaff is in that group, because only one horse in the last 43 Kentucky Derbies, only one horse has had more than two strikes, and that was mine, that bird, speaking of birds, and he had four strikes.
Well,
and it's interesting, while having lunch today with your friend, Ryan Stillman, it dawned on me that, you know, and I realized this because the original trainer of Rachel Alexander was on with Steve Beck on the radio this morning, and Steve Beck asked him, Wiggins, he said, Hal Wiggins, he asked him, was there ever a thought of running her in the Kentucky Derby? Because remember, she won the Kentucky Oaks by a mile. I mean, little over 20 lengths. And he said that the owner, much like the owner of Songbird, had ruled out the Kentucky Derby from day one, had never changed, and in fact, didn't even want to talk about the Kentucky Derby. So that was interesting. And especially from the standpoint that the trainer then said, you know, he was asked, do you have any regrets that, she wasn't in there? Because obviously, look at, this is a case where this would have made this gentleman a Kentucky Derby winning trainer, most likely, if Rachel had been in the race. Because, of course, she came back and beat the Kentucky Derby winner, Mind That Bird, in the Preakness. So it's not like she could, we don't know if she could beat Mind That Bird. She did beat that Mind That Bird. And it's interesting because he said that, it took a great ride by Calvin Burrell. As we all know, that was one of those rides for the ages on Mind That Bird. And he says, you have to think that Rachel would have won the race, too, from the standpoint that we would have had Calvin Burrell. Remember, he picked to ride Rachel in the Preakness over Mind That Bird. And that was unbelievable because... to think that anybody would get off a Kentucky Derby winner in their very next start in the Preakness, and not only that, to ride a filly, you know, is pretty mind-boggling. But he knew and who he felt was the better horse, and obviously he was proven right, because Rachel Alexander's going into the Hall of Fame this year, not Mind That Bird. But it tells you that very likely, had the decision been made to run Rachel in the Derby, she would have won it, And it made me realize, well, what kind of strikes would she have had in my system? And we checked it out today at lunch, and she would have had one strike because she had not run first, second, or third in a race at a mile and an eighth or longer prior to the what would have been her Kentucky Derby start. So you get a strike in that category if you haven't finished 1, 2, 3 at a mile and an eighth or longer. But that would have been her only strike. So she would have been a one-strike horse had she been in the Kentucky Derby and most likely would have won the Kentucky Derby. And that means the only horse that's ever won the Kentucky Derby since I've been able to do this, because you can only go back to 1973 in my Derby strike system, because one of my points of emphasis is graded stakes, and they only started grading stakes in the United States in 1973. So I can't go back farther than that with my system. So that means that even this one anomaly in my system, mind that bird, he was kind of really an anomaly, because had the best horse from that crop been in the Kentucky Derby, we wouldn't have the one four-strike horse, the one horse with more than two strikes. So that's pretty fascinating in and of itself, and something I never really connected those dots until today. So, but it really tells you that I think Dancing Candy, even though he's got three strikes, you know, I think he's just got the natural speed that he's going to be able to probably, unless he gets a bad start, he'll be able to set the pace, but be able to set it more comfortably. And the way this pace is shaping up, it's not looking like it's going to be all that much of a pace. You've got Dancing Candy, and you've got Outwork, and you've got Nyquist, and basically that's your pace. Now, one thing a lot of people, I think, are being a little too hasty in, and that's even starting to think that the pace may not be kind of slowish. Well, that's very unusual for a Kentucky Derby, because as a great person in racing, Charles Hatton, who was the guy that popularized the Triple Crown phrase for the Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont Stakes. That was his importance in this game. But in many of the stories he wrote about the Kentucky Derby, he made a point that you really pretty much always have a fast pace in the Kentucky Derby. And that's because it's understandable, because everybody's keyed up. It's an important race. The crowd is there. The horses are, you know, revved up. And so, I mean, you're not going to really look at a Kentucky Derby. It'd be very fluky to get what we would call a slow pace in, you know, in any Kentucky Derby, especially when you got 20 horses in there. And remember when you, or 19 or 18, I mean, we're not going to have six in there. Let's put it that way. And with such a big field, you know, everybody's trying to get a position early. And some of those jocks have to use their horse to try to get into some kind of position during that mad scramble in the early stages of the mile and a quarter race. That in and of itself means that you're very likely going to have, you know, a pretty quick pace. So, but the key for Dancing Candy is I don't think he's going to have to go anywhere close like he did in the Santa Anita Derby when he went 45-1, tied for the third fastest half in the history of the Santa Anita Derby. And considering how fast he went, it's no surprise that he would falter, and he not only finished fourth, but he got beat 13.25 lengths. But again, when you put this in the historical context, he finished better than any horse ever in the Santa Anita Derby that had gone 45 and change. Nobody had ever gone 44 and change. So, I mean, this was very, very historic what happened there for him. And it gives him the chance, I think, to bounce back, especially when we're not looking at, you know, a bunch of other speed horses in the race.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Dancing Candy. And the thing is, if you listen to Mike Smith's interview on U.S. Racing last week, he described Dancing Candy as a horse that was very relaxed until that race. And his theory was, you know, maybe the track just kind of made the horse run off, maybe spooked the horse a little bit, the sound of the mud and everything. So, you know, I think you're right on the fact that Dancing Candy, I think, can sit off the pace. Now, you know, you mentioned...
Well, but that's unproven with him, but I don't think... I think it isn't a question that he has to prove he can sit off the pace. I think, especially since Outwork, they're giving signals from that camp, the way he worked the other day and, mm-hmm. and the way that they're kind of training him. That I think Outwork is a horse that they don't really want to be in front early. So, like, his main pace rival in the race is really not too keen in being in front early. Now, things can change radically once the gate opens. But the way this is shaping up right now, I don't think the Nyquist group, they necessarily want to be in front of Lee. Now, if Nyquist breaks sharp and Gutierrez doesn't have to send him to make the lead and he just makes the lead on his own, that's one thing. But I don't think Nyquist... because they're not interested in being front early, I don't think he will be able to outrun Dancing Candy early. And the Dancing Candy people, they're obviously not going to send him. Mm-hmm. But again, he's just naturally fast. And the key with him is where he went 45 and 1/5 in the Santa Anita Derby, he'll be able to go much slower and still be in front without being used to do so, most likely, in the Kentucky Derby. Now, the fastest Santa Anita Derby half, there was one under 45. It was 44 and 4/5 by a horse called Cuz Was Wrong in 1977. But as I say, this is just so off the charts for Dancing Candy. And again, for him to be able to even finish fourth in a way was kind of a victory in defeat for him when you look at every other horse ever at Santa Anita to go that fast that early in the Santa Anita Derby. So, I mean, I fear Dancing Candy enough that even though he's got three strikes, because of the way this pace is shaping up and because he had looked so good in his three wins prior to the Santa Anita Derby, I do consider him dangerous in terms of the pace scenario of this race. So this is you guys mentioned it at the start of this, that this is kind of an inscrutable Kentucky Derby. And it really is, because you can go up and down the line with these horses. You can name any horse in the race pretty much, and I can give you some very compelling reasons why the horse could win, but I can also give you some compelling reasons why the horse can lose. And that starts right with Nyquist.
Right.
Because Nyquist is undefeated. He's a champion, but there's questions about him going 1.25 miles. And until he answers it, you just don't know. Now, I went back and looked at the replay of the San Vicente because I was planning to put Exaggerator at 1 on my Derby lists that I have to do for my ExpressBet.com and for the Louisville Courier-Journal that I have to rank 20 every week. But I thought, you know, let's go back and take a look at that San Vicente. And so I did, and they used Exaggerator much more than he wants to be early to try to stay close to Nyquist. So they took Exaggerator really out of his comfort zone in that race. And considering that, he actually ran a very good race, especially as fast as that race was. It was 120 and change. But what really was telling to me was on the gallop out after the finish, I had really thought probably the way Exaggerator finished in the Santa Anita Derby and the fact that he had had a more recent race, having run in the Delta Jackpot, a more recent race than Nyquist, who hadn't started since the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, I thought most likely Exaggerator would be the one who would get the upper hand on the gallop out. That was not the case at all. Nyquist galloped out much better than Exaggerator in that San Vicente. So that right there made me think, well, geez, I don't really think I'm that excited to put Exaggerator, have him leapfrog Nyquist. And then when you look at the past performances and the fact that Exaggerator and Nyquist have met three times, going clear back to a maiden race at Santa Anita last June, a race in which I made Nyquist 4-1 on the morning line, and he went off at 7 and he won that race. And Exaggerator finished 5th, and Exaggerator's lost 3 times. He's 0-3 against Nyquist. So, you know, why would I necessarily think all of a sudden that Exaggerator's going to turn the tables? Now, he might. He was that impressive in the Santa Anita Derby. And certainly if the track is wet, a lot of people are going to embrace Exaggerator, and for good reason. He was a winner in the mud in the Delta Jackpot. He won the Santa Anita Derby in the slop. But it's not like he's invincible on a wet track. He got beat at Saratoga, at Keeneland in the Breeders' Futurity by Brody's Cause on a muddy track. So he's not perfect on a wet track. But a lot of people with this big performance in the Santa Anita Derby are going to have that in their head. And if the track is wet for the Kentucky Derby, that's going to affect the odds for Exaggerator. And here again, Mike Battaglia who's been making the morning line for the Kentucky Derby for years and years and years, he's going to have to turn in that morning line the day that they draw, which is the most important post position draw of any race, I would say, in the world, certainly in the United States every year, because the post positions for the Derby are more meaningful than for any other race, because you really don't want the one or the two for sure. And when I'll have another who was my pick in the race, drew the 19, I won't utter the expletive that I said sitting on the air at the HRTV desk next to Millie Ball. I mean, I couldn't believe, and then I looked to see that no horse in the history of the Kentucky Derby had won from the 19 hole. Big Brown had won from 20, but no horse had won from 19. And, you know, when you're trying to, you're betting a horse and they're going to try to do something that's never been done in history, it doesn't exactly inspire confidence. But by the time I had driven home, I had kind of made peace with it. And I thought, you know what? If Big Brown could win from post 20, if I'll have another's the horse I think he is, the 19 hole will not get him beat. He might not be the horse I think he is, and he might not win. And considering he paid over $30, the odds were he wasn't going to win. But I didn't feel the post position was going to be the reason he got beat. And thanks to Trackus, he had run over five lengths farther than Bodemeister did, and people were so agog with the Bodemeister because of the pace that he set in that race that I knew that they were most likely going to make the wrong horse the favorite in the Preakness, and therefore I made a substantial wager on I'll have another in the Preakness, and he beat Bodemeister again. So, but this is the thing that in looking at these odds, Mike Battaglia will have to make the morning line right after the draw, and, you know, it could rain on Derby Day. And if it does, certainly you would make a different price on Exaggerator. You would lower the price on Exaggerator. So this is what I mean by being locked into these odds as a morning line maker so far in advance. For the Breeders' Cup, I have to make the odds on Monday for races that are going to be run Friday and Saturday, for Pete's sake. And you get a horse like American Pharoah who scratches, for instance. So this is where they've kind of really changed the complexion of these morning lines. And this is a perfect example, because if you were making the morning line for the Kentucky Derby the morning of the race, and, you know, in the early days of the morning line, now, obviously, there was always a line on the Kentucky Derby right after the draw because it's that important of a race. But again, on a general basis, it makes a big difference if you could make the morning line the morning of the races, unlike is the case today. So, but I mean, this Derby, you can go up and down the line. You dudes can say any horse. And I mean, there isn't a horse in the race that I would say I don't think has absolutely no chance, because the horse that has four strikes, Shagaff, I don't like him at this point, and I loved him go up to the Wood Memorial, but he had a good workout at Churchill already. You know, if the Wood Memorial is a throwout race, and that's a big if, but I certainly felt that way with Secretariat. Now, there's a big difference between Secretariat, who had been the horse of the year as a two-year-old, and Shagaff, who hasn't even cracked 90 on the buyer scale. And that's the biggest concern I have about Shagaff and a number of these horses, is the Shagaff has to run about 10 points faster to even have a chance in the Kentucky Derby. But, you know, I'm not thinking that it's going to take all that big of a buyer to win the Kentucky Derby this year. And, in fact, my ExpressBet.com column this week is going to detail some research that I did in terms of looking up the average buyer speed figure for the winner for the last 10 years and this year. So 10 years prior to this year and this year in the six Breeders' Cup races in the United States where you get 100 points to the winner. So those races, of course, are the Louisiana Derby, the Florida Derby, the Wood Memorial, the Bluegrass Stakes, the Santa Anita Derby, and the Arkansas Derby. And I've referred to those as the big six. So the average winning buyer speed figure for those six races last year was 102.8. For those same six races this year, 94.6.
Unreal. Wow.
Now you see, and this is very significant, because what it's telling us is, and this is one reason I was on Shagaf early this year, because the two biggest horses early in the year were horses that still had not even earned a triple-digit buyer, namely Nyquist and Mohamen. And Nyquist came out and did get a triple-digit in the San Vicente. But this is the thing, that the bar has not been set particularly high with this group this year. In other words, you had a much stronger group last year in terms of the buyer power going into the Kentucky Derby of those six important preps versus those six important preps this year. Now, I think you can look at this two ways. The first way, which is the way, you know, I'm kind of looking at this in both of these ways. The lower buyer speed figures this year compared to last year could play into the hands of Nyquist. Because the bar has not been set that high for him, even if the distance is a kind of a problem for him and so forth, he might be just fast enough against this group to win. In other words, what this is really saying is he may not have to beat that strong of a group this year to win the Kentucky Derby. So he doesn't necessarily have to be a super horse. In fact, as I was telling Ryan at lunch today, hey, Firing Line and Dortmund and Frosted, I would love probably this year in the Kentucky Derby. I think if any of those three ran their race that they ran in the Kentucky Derby last year, they might well win this year's Kentucky Derby. That's how low the bar has been set. Now, the caveat to that is I've seen through the years there are Kentucky Derbies where someone in this group will step it up on game day and, you know, run a kind of a breakthrough race to where they take their game to a higher level that they haven't done yet. For instance, that could be a Shagaf. You know, I don't think it'll happen, and especially since he's got four strikes in my thing, but the possibility is there. And the key for Shagaf is he wouldn't probably have a prayer last year because he'd have to be trying to beat American Pharoah, Firing Line, Dortmund, and Frosted. This year, he's trying to beat Nyquist and Exaggerator yeah. and More Spirit and Mohamen. Well, so in other words, this is a whole different ball game. Now, the other way I'm looking at this lack of buyer power this year, it tells me that it's quite possible that a horse will be able to win the Derby this year without running anywhere close to as well as American Pharoah last year. And that suggests that a horse may not have to step at all up all that much to pull off an upset. And it's one reason why I'm really taking a serious look and am planning to pick Lanny second in this race, because this is the dark horse of the race. He's the sleeper to me. And a lot of people are going to just throw him right out the window, but they don't really understand how dangerous this horse might be. For one thing, his trainer last fall was talking about that his plan was to run him in the Kentucky Derby. And this isn't some horse with some poor pedigree. I will tell you that there's not been a horse to ever run in the Kentucky Derby that has had a better pedigree than this horse. Maybe as good, but not better. This is the son of Tappet. The dam earned over $3 million and won one of the biggest races in Japan in a 74-1 upset in which Lanny's trainer was the rider of his dam in that big upset in which he defeated the reigning Japanese horse of the year and defeated a number of other top horses in that race. She's already produced a couple of horses that have earned over $1 million in Japan. And the fact that this guy was already looking at the Kentucky Derby last fall, and this guy's got a clue. He kind of is one of those, he just really indicates to me he knows what he's doing. And the proof of that is that his plan A was to run in the UAE Derby to get the points to run in the Kentucky Derby. And he even had a backup plan. And his backup plan was, if I send him to Dubai and he doesn't get the points to get into the Kentucky Derby, I'm going to run him in the Peter Pan and the Belmont Stakes. That's how high this guy is on this horse. Now, you might say, well, yeah, guys get on horses, high on horses. you know, big deal. Well, this guy was vindicated when this horse went to Dubai and won the UAE Derby. Now, his time wasn't that good, and Randy Moss estimated that the buyer, if you gave a buyer for the horse, was a paltry 86, as reported by the Racing Form's Jay Pribman, whereas on the same card, California Chrome would have got a 109. And the thing about the 86, though, is this horse stumbled badly at the start and raced quite wide, and this was pointed out by Steve Haskin for the Blood Horse. And, I mean, this horse actually ran a much better race than it appears on paper. And the filly that he beat, Polar River, is a very talented filly. There was another filly in there that would run second in the UAE Oaks, and she's from Argentina, so she's actually a four-year-old, and she didn't hit the board in the UAE Derby, but this is a very good filly, and she's been sent to the United States. So I think he actually beat a pretty good field in there. He even beat the winner of the El Camino Real Derby and the California Derby, Frank Conversation. Now, is Frank Conversation one of the top three-year-olds we have in the country? No, I wouldn't put him in the top probably 20, but he's probably in the top 40. So, I mean, at least it wasn't like this horse was beating a bunch of 25,000 claimers in this race or something. And again, he stumbled badly at the start and raced wide. So this is a horse that when you look at his past performances, a lot of people are going to say, well, he doesn't look very good. But right off the bat, just take a look at his very first race. Last September, he ran about a mile and a quarter on the turf as a two-year-old in his first race. Now, when's the last time you two dudes saw a two-year-old make his first start at a mile and a quarter?
I don't think I ever have.
So, I mean, here's a horse. I mean, people talk about, well, you know, do they have the stamina? His races so far have been at about a mile and a quarter, about a mile and an eighth, about a mile and an eighth, about a mile, about a mile. And when he won the UAE Derby, it was at the Preakness distance. It was about a mile and 3/16. So he's got plenty of stamina. And don't forget, I talked about the Dam having earned over $3 million and winning an important race in Japan, defeating the reigning horse of the year. This Dam, Heavenly Romance, is a daughter of none other than Sunday Silence, who, of course, won the 1989 Kentucky Derby. So, you know, this horse, it's there for him. Now, maybe he's just not fast enough to win the Kentucky Derby. There is that possibility. But I went back and looked at the tape of his, and it took me a long time to find it. But one thing about online these days, if you keep hunting, a lot of times you're going to find it. And I did find his first start in Japan this year. And he finished fifth in that race. And you'd think, well, that wasn't a very important race. And you would have thought that this guy would have kind of abandoned his plan for the UAE Derby and the Kentucky Derby off of that fifth-place finish in his first start this year. But I went back and watched this race, and this horse made a heck of a move on the far turn in that race. And the reason I had to try to find the tape of this, I needed to know if this horse deserved a strike in one of my strike categories. And one of those categories is the horse cannot have lost position in the final furlong in either of its last two races. And he did lose position. That's his one strike, as he was right there for the lead and ended up fifth in that race. But he was coming off a layoff. It was a prep race. And as I say, he did make a big move during the race, which showed me this horse actually can run some. And off of that fifth-place finish, he went over and won the big race. He won a $2 million race in Dubai. So, and the way he's going to be dismissed by a lot of people is that they don't train horses the same way we do, but that doesn't mean that it can't be successful. I mean, Japan has a whole different way of doing things. And yet, look at how well they've been doing on the world stage in recent years. Old Farb is a horse that barely lost in the Arc in France one year and came back and ran second to Trev in the Arc the next year. I mean, that horse made $19 million and lost two rich races, the Japan Cup by a nose that I was at, and he should have been placed first through the disqualification of Gentle Donna in that race. She came out several lanes and absolutely body slammed him during that race, and then he lost by a nose. They had an inquiry and made no change. Believe me, I mean, that was an absurdly bad call. And in fact, the American announcer, the guy that calls those races for the United States on TVG, Murray Johnson, we were out having drinks that night. And I said, what did you think of that? And he says, I can't believe they didn't take that down. And he used the phrase, he says, this was like in hockey where you body slam somebody. So how often do you see a horse get beat a nose that gets body slammed by the horse that beat him by a nose and there's no change? That's a race, one of the richest races in the world right there, that cost him money. And despite that, this horse made $19 million. But that's the kind of impact that horses from Japan have been having on the world stage. And I can tell you, the first time I ever had respect for horses running on the world stage was a number of years ago, a little over a decade ago at Hollywood Park, when they brought a filly over that had won the Japanese Oaks called Cesario. And believe me, this was one of the most impressive performances by a thoroughbred I've ever seen in person, along with a Rossi in the Breeders' Cup or Zenyatta in the Breeders' Cup Classic or some of these performances. Believe me, this one ranks right up there. And what one of the things that made it spectacular was after the post parade, Cesario got away from the rider, you know, ran off and actually had like a mini workout before the race. And if it was a case where the horse hadn't been sent all the way from Japan to run in the American Oaks, which that year had a purse of $750,000 and had an internationally strong field in that race, if they hadn't had, you know, they were going to err on the side of caution to scratch this filly. But if this was your typical race, most likely this horse would have been scratched for running off before the race. And then she blew the field away and won by four. And I mean, it was breathtaking. And that was a turning point for me, because from then on, I thought, wow, we better start respecting these horses from Japan. And even on the day that Lanny won the UAE Derby, there was another horse that won from Japan that won a $6 million race on that Dubai World Cup card. So would I be surprised to see a horse based in Japan win a Kentucky Derby? Not based on what I've been seeing Japan do, you know, in the last decade. And so, you know, this is a horse who's going to be a huge price. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've given serious thought to picking him on top, but I'm going to stick with Nyquist as far as the top pick, because I don't want to, like, be silly and have a horse who's undefeated and a champion. And just because I'm trying to be a wise guy, you know, I just, yeah. But I mean, I gave it that much serious consideration. And, you know, I think Lanny is very, very live in this race. And one of the reasons is he's only got one strike in my nine categories for my strike system. And as I say, I think there's a lot of talent there. The breeding is there. I think a lot of ability is there. And the biggest key is what we talked about in the buyers. The buyer bar is not set very high this year. So this horse, if we were last year, I wouldn't even take a look at Lanny, because, you know, American Pharoah I loved, and not only did I say I like him for the Kentucky Derby, but I said I think he's got the talent to maybe win the Triple Crown, and of course he did, and that was before the Kentucky Derby. And a lot of people picked Dortmund in the Kentucky Derby, and he was undefeated. I mean, I understand why, but I felt American Pharoah was, you know, Dortmund wasn't even the best horse in that barn, let alone in the race. And, of course, that's been proven in time. One horse was a Triple Crown winner, and the other horse has, you know, not won the Triple Crown, that's for sure, in Dortmund, who is a good horse, but he's got his physical issues right now. But this Lanny, if we were talking last year, I don't think he'd have a prayer, because he'd have to be beating American Pharoah, Firing Line, Dortmund, and Frosted. This year, with the bar not set that high, it makes him even more dangerous.
Last question, and you mentioned Nyquist as your top pick. I mean, do you think he gets a distance? Or like you said earlier, and kind of what Halterman and I have talked about in the past, is it more like, you know, maybe he's not going to get the distance, but it's just he's just better horse than the rest of them?
Well, that's exactly right of what could happen, and especially, again, when we look at these speed figures, because, as I say, he doesn't necessarily have to be the greatest maybe mile and a quarter horse to win it this year. I mean, circumstances dictate things. I mean, Bull Forbes won at Belmont because he got one of the greatest training jobs in history and one of the greatest rides in history, but he wasn't a mile-and-a-half horse. But against that field on that day, the way he was trained and the way he was ridden, he was able to barely eke out a win in a mile-and-a-half. That's one of the greatest accomplishments by a trainer and a jockey and by that horse, considering he was basically like, I mean, it'd be like you know, just a sprinter winning the Belmont Stakes practically is what that was. I mean, it wasn't that far from that. I mean, he was basically a really and truly a sprinter. It was great for them to be able to win the Kentucky Derby with that horse at a mile and a quarter. Forget the Belmont at a mile and a half. But the circumstances on a particular day, you know, indicate that a horse can maybe do something that, you know, Nyquist would be, have trouble at a mile and a quarter race last year against American Pharoah. But I don't see any American Pharoahs in this group. Now, there may be one lurking, and we may see one, you know, come Derby Day and after the race. But at this point, and the evidence is continued, you know, it isn't that we're looking at one or two races. This is looking at the entire. I also checked the average winning buyer speed figures for all the races with 50 points to the winner this year. So I looked at that in conjunction with the 100-point races, and it's the same thing. Again, out of the last, if you count this year and go back 10 years before this year, so that's 11 years, this year ranks clearly at the bottom. And that just is telling us that this buyer bar is set very low this year. And it makes it interesting because, as I say, you can look at this and say, hey, this is a year in which we may get a, you know, the second lowest group was Animal Kingdom that year. That's the second lowest average winning buyer for the big six races. And look at what the things that Animal Kingdom did that was kind of off the charts. He'd never run on the dirt. You know, he had a lot of time between the Spiral and the Derby. He's one of those horses that had fewer than six starts. I mean, he was one of the most lightly raced Kentucky Derby winners in history. He did a lot of things that you would normally say, well, gee, I wouldn't have expected him to do that. But again, the bar, you can look back now and say, well, the bar was set low for him in that Derby, you know, because that was the one next to this year out of the last 10 before this year and including this year that had the lowest average winning buyer speed figures. So, you know, this is the key that we're not looking at that strong of a bunch like we were last year. I mean, that was the thing. It wasn't just American Pharoah. And I think this is a real testament to American Pharoah's greatness again, too, that maybe is lost on some people. They don't realize what kind of crop that he was running in. For him to win the Triple Crown is, of course, tremendous in itself. But to do it against one of the strongest groups that we've had, you know, you can make a case that there's no question that three-year-old group from last year ranks among the top of the last 50 years. I mean, it's in the mix with all of them. I would certainly put the Street Sense, Curlin, that one, you know, Hard Spun and Rags to Riches in that group. That's one of my favorites and certainly one of the strongest and probably stronger than last year. But that group last year is right there, you know, with any of them in history, to be honest, as far as Kentucky Derbies. And that, to be able to be superior enough to win those three races at three different tracks, at three different distances, I mean, really, again, gives a glimpse of the greatness of American Pharoah. And, you know, he was so vulnerable in the Derby because of getting, you know, acting up on that Mardi Gras atmosphere walkover that's turned that into. And Baffert was very concerned, as washy as he was. And, I mean, this horse, remember his first race, this horse went nuts. And remember, he raced with air plugs. I mean, this wasn't like the calmest horse in history. And it's enough to be running in before a crowd that big. But when there was all this zoo atmosphere just walking over from the barn area, really, you know, you had Bud Light, you know, these girls, the drink girls that were the sponsors, yep, that were involved and, you know, all this stuff going on. And it really got him keyed up. And that's the race that if he's a mortal horse, and like all these other horses that would have been close to a Triple Crown winner, he gets beat because Firing Line ran that good of a race, the race of his life, so good that not only has Firing Line not raced since the Preakness, which, you know, he came back and ran up the track in the Preakness, but he hasn't run again since the Preakness, and he hasn't had a workout. We're, you know, almost to May, and he has yet to have a workout. So that's the kind of toll it took on Firing Line. But that's how big a race Firing Line ran in the Kentucky Derby, with a great ride by a great rider that is able to win big races like the Kentucky Derby and beat a horse like American Pharoah when they have a little bit of an off day. And there's no question, American Pharoah had, that was not his A game that day, without any doubt. And yet, that's the sign of a Michael Jordan, or, you know, the all-time greats that can sit there and at the biggest race, sit there and not have their A game and still win a Kentucky Derby. Think of that, guys, that how hard it is to win the Kentucky Derby if you run your A race. And yet, here's a horse that was so great, he didn't run his A race and he won it. And that's why I really knew, I felt before the Derby, he had a good chance for the Triple Crown, and I had bet him to win the Triple Crown. But when he won the Derby without running his A race, I was very confident he'd win the Triple Crown, particularly since he had the breeding to get the mile and a half. And that's going to be very interesting if Nyquist does win the Kentucky Derby and prove that he can win it a mile and a quarter, and now he's 8-for-8. Chances are he will come back and win the Preakness, because that's what we've seen through our time, that that's the race that oftentimes the Derby winner comes back, because so many of the Derby horses go by the wayside. They can't win the Triple Crown now, and trainers today don't really want to run their horses back in 2 weeks anyway. So there's not much incentive to run in the Preakness, and that's why the I'll Have Another's and the Real Quiet's and the Silver Charmer, you go right down the line, Smarty Jones. I mean, these horses, funny side, I mean, they come right back and win the Preakness. If Nyquist is good enough to win the Derby and has the stamina to win the Derby, there's a very good chance he'll come back and win the Preakness, especially since he has been campaigned kind of with the Triple Crown grind in mind by the connections, because, they, of course, they had I'll Have Another who had to scratch the morning of the Belmont because he was injured. And their feeling is, we want as fresh a horse as possible if we ever get back in those shoes again. And so they have a very fresh horse in Nyquist. But the key with him is, even if he wins the Derby in a mile and a quarter, a mile and a half is such a different ball game even than the mile and a quarter, that that's going to be the one that I think is going to be a huge question mark for him. And there's some horses lying in the weeds that could be big threats to him in the Belmont, like a Unified maybe, or even a Stradivari. You know, these are the type of horses I think that could be. And that's one thing that helped American Pharoah. He did not have one of these tonalists lying in the weeds, or like when Woody Stevens was winning so many Belmonts back in the day. So that helped American Pharoah. He basically was running against the same bunch, and he'd already proven his superiority over that bunch. But that Belmont is a race that, you know, we've seen so many times through the years be won by these horses that come out of the Peter Pan, like an AT Indy or so forth. You know, these horses that I call them coming out of the weeds. And Nyquist is going to have a couple. And the other issue for a horse like Nyquist is, even though he's relatively fresh going into the Kentucky Derby, any way you slice it, the Triple Crown is a grind. And it's a grind on a horse, not only physically, but it is a grind mentally. It's a grind. And that's why it takes really a superior equine athlete to pull it off, to win the three. And if Nyquist can do it, obviously he will be a superior equine athlete. But, you know, it's going to be enough for him to prove that he can win the Kentucky Derby. But unlike American Pharoah, and even I'll Have Another, I had confidence in I'll Have Another at the mile and a half. He was bred beautifully for the mile and a half. Rags to Riches, I couldn't have been more confident in her. She had one of the greatest Belmont pedigrees you'll ever see, a half-sister to a Belmont winner, her sire a Belmont winner, the sire of the sire of Belmont. I mean, you went right down the line. I mean, it was Belmont Stakes a mile and a half all through her bloodlines. And that's so important for that race. And that's not there for Nyquist. I mean, and it's trickier to win the Belmont just being the superior horse than even the Derby, because it's so much farther than the Derby. So even if he proves in the Derby, like we were saying, that he's just kind of the best of this group, but he's not really truly a mile and a quarter horse, that's what makes the Belmont a real big question mark for him, even if he heads into it with a chance for the Triple Crown.
Yeah, no doubt. John, thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to go check out John's articles over at expressbet.com to not only learn about his Derby strikes and how that system works, but to follow the analysis throughout The Triple Crown Trail, that's one thing I enjoyed more than anything last year, was reading all of John's Express Bet articles as American Pharoah, you know, made his chase to history, and it was obviously turned out to be really cool. So again, John, thanks so much for joining us, and we hope to have you back sometime.
Sounds great, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, John.
Wow. I mean, what an interview that is.
Yeah, that was everything we hoped for and more. We got so much knowledge out of that interview. I don't know how you can't not win in the Kentucky Derby now, right? I mean, it's laid all out there for us.
I mean, he threw out a horse that everyone's disliking in Lanny, that he almost wants to pick on top, which is pretty amazing to say. Yeah, this is he's got some wild ones, but just his inside, everything, the inside on More Spirit, and that workout and the history, the history he showed is just unreal. It's unmatched.
It is, and yeah, you could just tell this guy has got experience in this game that, like you said, it is unmatched by anyone.
All right, that's all the time we have. Check us out at racingdudes.com for our free picks and our premium selections on our handicapping products page. 100% money back guarantee. And now covering all tracks. The initial version of our Kentucky Oaks Derby wagering guide is now available for download. This is a 20-page guide jam-packed with all the information you need to make the best possible wagers for the Oaks and Derby. So here's the deal, how this breaks down. You can purchase the Kentucky Oaks and the Derby and the Preakness picks for $15 each, $45, or you can purchase the one-month pro package for the same price, $45, and get the Oaks, Derby, 20-page wagering guide, the Preakness, plus every other track for the whole entire month. Like, not as in, like, the month of May or the month of April, but, like, a month long. It's a no-brainer. So you get all that plus everything else. We're currently covering 28 tracks, all offering free picks. 28 tracks, really?
It's 28 tracks, yeah, man. Like I've been telling you, we're going to get up to 30 soon. And I got to tell you something on that package. I bought three of them already.
Wow. Thank you for doing that. It's actually, we've actually lost money on that deal, I think. But I appreciate the support. 28 tracks, all free picks. We're on Twitter at @race_dudes, LinkedIn, Google Plus, and Facebook. Make sure you go follow John White on Twitter or go read his columns on ExpressBet. This guy is amazing, and he'll give you the information. If you hate us, he'll give you the information you need. I'm Jared Welch. Be their helpman. Good luck this week. For all of your needs, racingdudes.com. For all of your leads, racingdudes.com. For all of your bets, racingdudes.com. As good as it gets.